The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. Teleconferences and podcasts were added to the resources available online in 2012. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. Thank you so much for joining us for today's brief overview and discussion on this podcast with two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Aaron Finkelstein, the managing attorney, and Chris Drinan, a senior attorney, each of whom has about 30 plus years of experience. And between the three of us, we have about 100 years of experience, a century and going. And the reason you have all of the senior people is because we think this is such an important topic to go over with you today. And our focus, of course, is the current state of the Customs and Border Protection, airport-related issues, what we call POE, Port of Entry, in the second Trump administration. Of course, I know we have all dealt with permanent residents who have been detained because of prior criminal issues. And there's definitely greater enforcement of returning permanent residents after lengthy absences from the U.S. So that's just a very quick overview. And with that, I'm going to have Chris jump in to discuss expedited removal orders. Chris.
Thank you, Sheila. An expedited removal order is basically the most serious problem that can occur at a port of entry. I know it's called removal, but this is essentially what we used to call deportation. But this type of deportation that happens at the airport, it doesn't go through the normal immigration court system. Essentially, if you receive an expedited removal order, the only person who's making that decision is a supervisory CBP officer. There's no judge. There's no sort of review here. This is a decision by an officer at the port, and they have complete discretion to do this. This is obviously a very serious thing. If you are expeditiously removed from the United States, your visa is canceled. They'll physically cancel the visa in your passport and cancel it in the database. And they will impose a 5-year ban on reentering the United States. In other words, you cannot come back to the United States in any status for 5 years without applying for a waiver of that inadmissibility. And that is not a quick process. If you're applying for a waiver, you would have to apply at the U.S. Embassy in conjunction with a new visa application. And that process is relatively informal, but it takes a long time because the way it works is initially a consular officer can recommend an approval of the waiver. Obviously, they don't have to. They're going to listen to your story. They're going to look at whatever documents you bring. But they're going to make a recommendation one way or the other. If the consular officer who you speak with recommends the approval, they have to forward that recommendation electronically to the U.S. Department of State in Washington, D.C. And headquarters in Washington, D.C. might agree with the recommendation, but they might not. But they have the final say. Even if the officer at the consulate recommends the grant of a waiver, headquarters in D.C. can still deny it, regardless of that. They have complete discretion on that. Processing time start to finish on a waiver like this traditionally is at least 6 months. You'll sometimes see them come back quicker than that, but as a rule, it's at least 6 months and sometimes longer than that. So it's a very serious problem, and it's not easily resolved if it happens. Now you can run into an expedited removal in a number of different contexts. We see them probably most commonly in H-1B situations where someone is coming in with an H-1B visa, and there's a discrepancy in the work location and your home address. Or maybe Customs and Border Protection calls your employer or calls your end client. They give answers to CBP's questions that are different from what you've told them. So all of this can result in an expedited removal, essentially a situation where Customs and Border Protection thinks you're lying to them or thinks that your visa was not validly issued or that you've committed fraud. I mean, all of these things can trigger an expedited removal. Now, for any foreign national entering the United States, they can also be expeditiously removed. This is not just H-1Bs. Maybe there's something in your luggage that shouldn't be there, or maybe CBP has looked through your phone or through your laptop and found things in there that are not consistent with your stated reason for coming to the U.S., saying you're a visitor, but you've got freshly updated resumes on your computer, or you have job applications. In other words, they find something that is different from what you have told them. And all of these things can result in an expeditious removal. CBP has enormous, enormous discretion here.
Thank you, Chris. So, Aaron, we're going to jump to you now to say, okay, we're hearing the problems, we're seeing the problems, we're unfortunately having to deal with it. So what needs to be done? What can be done in this kind of a situation, Aaron?
Okay, so thank you, Sheila. And just before I jump into that, I just want to make one point from what Chris was saying, which was fantastic, is just that also it doesn't have to be contraband that they find on you, or it doesn't have to be, for example, there was a woman who was an Indian national who came in on a B-1 or a B-2 visa, and she had 6 suitcases. And they opened up the suitcases, and they saw that she had gotten married, and she had her marriage gifts with her. And they said, oh, you're married. Who are you married to? Oh, you're married to a green card holder or to a U.S. citizen. Okay, that tells us you have immigrant intent. So it doesn't have to be a smoking gun. It could be just regular, normal things that they impute value to. So please take that into account. Okay, so what could be done after you have an order of expedited removal? The first thing you need to know is that they're supposed to provide the copies of the documents that they put together for the expedited removal. Generally, this includes a Q&A, questions and answers that they went through with you, and it includes the actual order of the expedited removal indicating that you've been removed from the U.S. The first thing you need to do is you need to review these statements very carefully, and you need to test them for veracity, to test them to see if they're true. If you find inconsistencies in the statements, if you find recharacterization of the way the officer said something, if you find something that the officer said that you said but you didn't say it, or not exactly the way the officer understood it, etc., that gives you a basis to challenge the order directly to CBP. However, the CBP doesn't have to allow you to challenge, and their willingness to look at the findings that you say that are, hey, there's inaccurate statements of fact, and we have supporting evidence to show that the facts went in a different direction, that's going to be, you know, that's going to depend on the specific port that issued the expedited removal order. And I will tell you that Murthy Law Firm has had success in having expedited removal orders changed from expedited removal to withdrawal of admission, which still leaves the visa canceled, but the withdrawal does not involve any bars. And in that situation, no waivers would be required at the consulate when applying for another visa. However, they will ask you about the incident, and they will want you to explain what happened. So you have to be prepared to address it. And again, Murthy Law Firm's ability to help someone try to overcome the expedited removal order really depends on the facts of the case and on that test of the veracity, that truth test, to see if you can find these inconsistencies. There is no judicial review or other appeal available. And if you can't get it overturned, you need to file a waiver in order to return to the U.S.
Thank you, Aaron. So I know we're a little short on time. We wanted to do this for less than 20 minutes. We're kind of at 10 minutes plus. So at this point, let's just figure out what Aaron just referred to as what's called the withdrawal of admission, right? So what does that really mean, and how does that process work? So you as a foreign national, if you're entering the U.S., you're allowed to ask or request, if they threaten to give you an expedited removal order with a 5-year bar, you can say, could I please get a Section 275 withdrawal of my request to be admitted or to enter the U.S.? What does that mean? Because it's basically the officer has already made a decision that you're not going to be allowed into the country or refused admission into the U.S. And if the officer, the CBP officer, says, okay, I'll do that, it's obviously less severe than an expedited removal order. And why? Because there's no 5-year bar against you, right? But as Aaron just mentioned, the visa is canceled, the admission is denied, and more appropriate than the expedited removal order in most cases is where the CBP officer will then question eligibility but does not find fraud or misrepresentation or immigrant intent, then they're more likely to say, oh, you didn't bring the proper documents or you're having an eligibility issue as opposed to a fraud, misrepresentation, or what Aaron just gave in that example, the immigrant intent. You will still need the new visa as we just talked. You will likely face tough questioning at the consulate. You should be prepared to address the CBP officer's stated reasons for the refusal of your admission or visa, the refusal of why you are not allowed into the U.S. And in some cases where there's been a withdrawal of the admission, the consular officers end up with making a fraud finding based on the information that the CBP had collected from you during the interview. And again, that is being reinforced during the visa interview. And one of the things that I think Aaron mentioned and that when we were discussing this is you cannot be granted a withdrawal if you have had unlawful employment, because that's considered a big problem. Work without authorization is a huge, big no-no. Chris, I know there's lots and lots of situations where we've done tons of consultations on I-94's cards being shortened, truncated, as they call it, because of visa, because of passport expirations, et cetera. Do you want to just briefly touch upon that issue?
Yes, Sheila. I-94 problems are something we talk about pretty routinely. And as I suspect most of the people listening to us know, the I-94 is what defines how long you can actually remain in the United States. Used to be a white paper card. Now it's generally not. It's basically, it's mostly an online database that you can look up on the internet. But essentially the I-94 says how long you can stay here. And there's sort of a whole universe of problems that basically involve the I-94, having a different date than you would expect. The most common scenario is someone who has an I-797 approval notice, for example, for an H-1B that has one date, and they realize that the I-94 they were issued when they came in through Customs and Border Protection has a different date. There are a lot of ways that can happen. Sometimes it's a mistake by CBP. A lot of times they will just look at the visa stamp in your passport and just give you that date instead of giving you the date on your 797 notice, which is what they should give you. Now, of course, you have to give them the 797 notice. That's one thing to remember. If you want the full period of admission that's on your, for example, your H-1B petition, you have to give it to them. Otherwise, they are just going to look at what's on your visa stamp as a general rule. It's also important to review your I-94 when you come in through the U.S. We try to remind people about this all the time. You should always check it after you come through customs to make sure that you were given the date that you expected, because it's much easier to fix if you've just come through customs and you're still at the airport. But a lot of times people are tired. They've just gotten off a very long plane flight. They don't look. And they sometimes don't look until the I-94 they've gotten has already expired, and they're trying to extend their status, and they find their status has potentially already expired. Now, sometimes you can correct this if it's a Customs and Border Protection mistake. If you handed them your passport with the visa and you handed them your 797 and they gave you the date that was just on the visa stamp, that's a mistake. And that can be potentially fixed at what's called the Deferred Inspections Office, which is most airport CBP facilities will have a Deferred Inspections Office. You can find the addresses and the phone numbers online. But something like that where it's a CBP error, that can sometimes be fixed, but not always. Sometimes CBP, depending on the office, won't fix it if the I-94 is already expired. They won't fix it if your passport did not cover all the time that you're asking for, or they will not fix it if it is entirely the applicant's fault. In other words, if it occurred because you got the shortened date because you didn't give them the 797, CBP won't fix that. They're going to say that's your mistake. And one thing in closing, a very common thing that people get tripped up on here is, as a general rule, CBP cannot admit you beyond the expiration of your passport. So you might have an H-1B approval, a 797, that's valid for 2 more years. If your passport expires in 7 months, you're not going to get that full 2 years. You're going to get passport expiration. And if you're not aware of that, that can cause very, very serious problems. So you really have to look at your I-94 online after you come in.
Thank you, Chris. Very, very helpful. I know this is one of the most common consultations we get at the Murthy Law Firm. And let's jump to some of these other complication issues where we talk about referrals to secondary inspections, surgical electronic devices, all of that. Aaron, if you could just jump in, talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I want to talk about other issues that can happen at the port of entry. So some of them happen where you get referred to secondary inspection. Sometimes you get it referred to secondary inspection where it's random. Some are due to questions CBP officers have. Some are due to documentation issues or to the answers that you provided them that they can't handle during primary. Now, a lot of times they have to clear through their primary lines in order to look through and to see your documents and to see your situation to clear you in secondary. So that means if you're referred to secondary inspection, that could lead to lengthy delays. Sometimes you could be waiting many hours. And also once they've completed, you might be, you know, facing some intense questioning. So you need to be prepared to be able to respond to that. At secondary is usually where they'll do searches of your belongings, are allowed, your luggage, like we referred to earlier about the lady who had her suitcases reviewed. But they can also look at your electronic devices. They can look at your text messages, at your emails. They can look at documents that you're carrying with you. This includes like inspecting social media stuff. If you say, look, that's my personal stuff, I'm not going to give you my password or my code, okay, you can do that, and they can deny you admission into the U.S. So be aware that saying no may result in them simply denying you an admission into the United States.
Great. Thank you, Aaron. So, of course, if you've laid out the problem, our attitude is, what can you do? What your concern, of course, is, hey, how can you guys help me? Any suggestions, any ideas? One of the things we tell people is ideally you want to arrive during normal business hours on a weekday so that your employer, the H-1B company, the end client, are able to be contacted by the CBP Customs and Border Protection officer to confirm the details of your employment, your work location, you know, what you've said and what's on your petition is in fact accurate and still current and valid. And for lawful permanent residents, what are you seeing, Chris?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of some of the most common calls I've gotten in recent times are from lawful permanent residents. And we've seen a lot of things in the news about lawful permanent residents having issues at the port of entry. In some cases, people even being detained. That's not the norm, but it the current administration, there is definitely a little more stringent enforcement in terms of green card holders returning to the U.S. I don't want to spend too long on this, and we're nearing the end of our time here, but the main thing to remember is lawful permanent residents do not have an absolute right to enter the United States. They're not U.S. citizens. If you have been convicted of certain crimes that make you inadmissible to the United States, or if you've been out of the United States for longer than 6 months, you can potentially be denied admission. You don't have an absolute right to enter. You can be treated as what's called an arriving alien and put in removal proceedings. In other words, deportation proceedings. In some cases, if you have criminal convictions that are serious enough to make you inadmissible to the U.S., you could even be detained. And we've seen a few stories in the news media about that. Lawful permanent residence does not mean you have an absolute right to enter the U.S. Criminal convictions or outside the U.S. for longer than 6 months, you can have issues. So these are all things you have to be careful about.
Oh, I meant to ask you, what about the 407, abandon your lawful permanent residence, that they're being asked to sign sometimes at the airport?
Yeah, but you most commonly see that issue, Sheila, for people who are permanent residents and they've been out a long time, even longer than 6 months or potentially longer than a year in some cases. They are given the option to abandon their permanent resident. That's the I-407 form. Now, the thing to remember is you can refuse to sign the I-407 if you do not believe you've abandoned your residence by staying out too long. Or if you want to contest that, If you're a permanent resident and CBP is saying you've been outside the U.S. for too long, you've abandoned your residence, you have an absolute right to request a hearing in front of an immigration judge. Because CBP does not themselves have the right to take away your residence. Only an immigration judge can do that. So in all of these instances, you do have a right to go in front of a judge and contest this. And you can show proof that you did not intend to abandon your residence and that you still considered yourself a permanent resident of the United States. And in certain circumstances, you can win that case in front of an immigration judge.
Chris, how long does it take to get in front of the immigration judge?
With the current backlogs in the immigration court, unfortunately, that is an extremely lengthy process. You might not have your first hearing for a year or longer.
Yeah, I have somebody who's waiting since 2016. So, like, I'm just saying, be prepared for a long wait. And, Chris, one last question, and then I'm going to let Sheila wrap up. But I'm just wondering, can the person travel, or do they have to wait in the U.S., or is traveling problematic?
Traveling is problematic because if you are in removal proceedings, in other words, if you are in what is essentially a deportation case, which is what this is, you could be considered to have self-deported. In other words, deported yourself if you leave the country. In practice, it was pretty common in former years, it was pretty common that people were allowed to depart and re-enter while they're waiting for their hearing in front of the judge. It doesn't seem like that's being honored anymore. I've heard of some cases where people who tried to travel while they were waiting for the hearing have not been permitted to re-enter the U.S. and have been considered to have deported themselves.
Correct. Well, as you can see from this discussion, and we tried to make it short, sweet, powerful, and strong with my brilliant, esteemed colleagues, Aaron Finkelstein and Chris Dreiman, on the hot topics and the issues that would concern you, whether it's you individually, your family member, or your employees that are entering the United States, and the sorts of issues that we're commonly seeing. They certainly remain challenging. They require attention. They require accuracy. You have to look at the documents you prepare, et cetera. And hopefully you will not end up triggering either a 5-year bar, a lifetime bar, or complications. But God forbid you do. You certainly know that we at the Mufti Law Firm have the capability, the ability to guide you, to hold your hand. Obviously, it's never 100% guarantee because you have far fewer legal rights when you're entering the U.S. at the port of entry from CBP. On behalf of Aaron Finkelstein, Chris Dreiman, myself, and the entire Mufti Law Firm team, thank you for joining us for today's podcast and discussion, and we look forward to continuing to help you, your family, your friends, your colleagues. Take care and have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Mufti Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.